Okay, we are in 1 Peter, the 3rd chapter, if you'd like to turn in your New Testaments there. We actually started our discussion of verses 1 through 6, talking about the responsibility of wives to be in submission to their husbands, a popular subject these days. And we're going to continue our discussion of that text, possibly discuss verse 7, talk a little bit about the husband's responsibilities as well. Jeremiah, would you mind starting us off by reading the first 6 verses of 1 Peter 3?
Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they without a word may be won by the conduct of their wives, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. Do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are, if you do good and are not afraid with any terror.
Thank you. We actually started this section of our study with only about, I'd say, 12 to 15 minutes left in our class. So if you are in your book, if you do have a book with you, it's on page 9, and we actually only answered the first question. I just wanted to just basically restate what we talked about very quickly, concisely, and we'll get into the second question. The first question was the call for submission that is given here specifically to women with husbands who are not Christians, and how can it be a challenge? We talked about the idea of submitting oneself means to subordinate or subject yourself to, in this case, your husband. We had previously talked about the requirement of, in verse 18 of chapter 2, of servants to be submissive to their masters with all fear. And notice here, again, there is a challenge here, because it's not only to those who are good and gentle, but that a servant is to submit themselves to a master, even one who is harsh. And so here we kind of have a similar or parallel command given, because we are told not only to submit, the wives to submit to their husbands if they're Christian, if they're living righteously, if they're seeking to do what they should do. Perhaps notice verse 7 of 1 Peter 3, that we're not just talking about a husband who is dwelling with understanding and giving honor to the wife and treating her as an heir together with him with the grace of life, but we're talking now about a Christian, or a man who's not a Christian, who still, the call to submit is given. And so we wanted to know something about the challenges, and we talked about how there could be some impediments that the non-Christian husband might put in the path of the wife as she's seeking to serve the Lord. Antagonism toward religion, perhaps problems that surround the children with regard to his unwillingness to conduct himself in such a way as to bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. So all of these kinds of things can make it sometimes very difficult to submit. But the call is to submit. And if you remember, we talked about the way in which you look at this, and again, it's an allusion back to what we read with regard to the servants being submissive to their masters, that when you do that, is you do it not as unto men, but as unto the Lord. In other words, you recognize that ultimately the responsibility is not to the husband. That's an outgrowth of the fact that what is being done is in response to an instruction that is given by the Lord himself. It is what the Lord requires. But we also talked about the fact that there are limits. And so we should not obey a command to forsake God. You know, if the husband says, that you can't serve God anymore because you're my wife, you have to do what I say, so you can't be a Christian. Well, of course, then that's not something that you can do. We must obey God rather than man. At the very end of our time together, I just made an allusion to 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So I'd like you to turn with me there, and then I'll just make a note of what is stated in verse 15. Didn't have a chance to read it. I just alluded to it to indicate, again, this concept of a limit with regard to what is required of the woman in this case. And then we'll open it up to any questions or comments you have, and then we'll get into the next question. But you'll notice in in chapter 7, beginning in verse 10, the Apostle Paul tells those who are married, he said, I command this, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. And again, within the context here, you have an idea of a believing wife and an unbelieving husband, in the same scenario that you have in 1 Peter 3. And understand this, the question would naturally arise. You have two people who aren't Christians. They hear the gospel for the first time. The wife obeys the gospel, becomes a Christian. The husband rejects it. So the wife asks the question, what do I do now? Should I leave him? I've got to serve God. So now I'm married to a man who's a pagan and he doesn't have an interest in serving Jesus Christ. So what do I do? And so the instructions are the marriage relationship is something that God has determined to be a lifetime relationship. You're not to leave. So you're to remain. So we can see how that coincides with the instructions in 1 Peter 3 and verse 1. That here's a wife who has an unbelieving husband. You're to submit. So you're not to depart. But in verse 15 of the text, he says, but if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. God has called us to peace. So if you have an unbeliever who is basically setting, and again, I can understand that maybe scenarios are slightly different from this, but this is a scenario that would apply in this particular case. An unbeliever who basically puts the line in the sand. You've got to choose me or God. I'm not going to live with a Christian. So what do we have to do there? If the call is to submit to your husband, does that mean then that you have to submit to him and in effect be in bondage to him, be a slave to him, and do what he says when he requires you to leave the Lord? And the answer is no. If he's not willing to live with you as a Christian and he departs, he can depart. You're not the one to leave. But if he's not willing to live with you, then you let him depart. And you're not responsible for that. That's the concept that is given in chapter 7 and verse 15. So there is, I wouldn't say a caveat, but there's a limit to this concept of submission even to husbands who are not Christians. That's not the point of 1 Peter 3:1, by the way. That's not what's being indicated, but I think it's important that we flesh this out so that we understand what is under consideration. In this case, you have someone who is willing to live with his wife, but now she's a Christian. Now what do I do? What is my relationship to him to be? And it is one of submission and of chaste conduct so that by some means you can bring him to faith. And that's the purpose of your behavior. But the submission remains, the requirement of submission remains, even if the spouse is an unbeliever. And so it's a difficult thing. It has challenges, but it is something that is required. Okay, so with those thoughts in mind, are there any questions? Anybody unclear about what is required there in chapter 3 and verse 1 is what we talked about last week and then very quickly here. Okay, if not, then we'll go on to question number 2. Okay, so the second question centers around verse 2 of the text. Because he says in verse 1 that wives are to be submissive, so that if some do not obey the word. So here is a situation. Again, keep in mind, you've got two individuals. They've heard the gospel. One has responded. One has rejected the gospel. The word of God, they've rejected it. They've not responded to it. Is there a possibility of still winning that person to Christ? They're not interested in hearing the word. But what if the word is demonstrated in your life? That's the point that is being made here. So if someone is not obeying the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct. Now, the gospel is the power of God to salvation. There is no substitute for the gospel of Jesus Christ. But again, there are ways to demonstrate that gospel. So I've given this as an example a number of times, and perhaps you could anecdotally supply some of your own, because there are several women that I could talk to. But the one that I like to talk about, because she was a member here, all up until the day she died, is Jeanette Hawk and her husband Elvin Hawk. And Elvin was antagonistic toward her her spirituality, her desire to serve Christ for a long, long time. Was not helpful with regard to her getting her children ready to come to worship. Was not a spiritual leader in the home. And this circumstance persisted for probably 50 years. I would imagine they were Probably. I would imagine maybe even more, 55. I don't know exactly how old Elvin was when he died, but about 8 months before he died, he had a massive heart attack, started thinking about his life and eternity, and he had paid attention to her example, and we talked to him about it after we baptized him, and he said, you know, the single overriding influence that led him to become a Christian is the fact that no matter how antagonistic he was, no matter how hard he made it for her, that she was faithful. And he understood that what she had was special, and he understood that what she had was something he needed, and he finally became obedient to the gospel. And, you know, it wasn't long after that before he finally passed away. But she won him without a word. You know, the word, the preachers had come to his house and tried to teach him, and he wasn't interested, and efforts had been made. I have no doubt that in the past she had tried to teach him, but she was a chaste and godly woman, and her example finally won him over, and very late in life. It's just a neat example. Something similar happened with my grandparents. Some of y'all knew Walter before he passed away. He was a member here for a number of years, and he obeyed the gospel late in life. Wasn't interested early on, but my grandmother, she was faithful and continued to be faithful despite his antagonism, and the same thing happened. So there are any number of examples we could give, but that's what we're talking about, someone who might win with their conduct. So keeping that in mind, the question actually that we want to discuss is what is that conduct? and how is it effective? And so when he says they may be won by the conduct of their wives, he actually defines that conduct in verse 2, when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. So what is chaste conduct? What does that mean? Got two things, characteristics that are mentioned in this. First is chasteness.
Faithfulness to her husband. She's to be faithful to her husband. She's also being faithful to God in the same realm there. But you know, it carries on later with what we're reading about how the wife is to treat her husband, even if he's not being the husband that he should be to her. She continues to be faithful in her duties to him, physically, emotionally, and I'd have to say spiritually too, because she's recognizing, you know, their God-given roles in life. Regardless of whether he is or isn't.
Yeah, and you're talking about that idea of faithfulness, and I think that's tied in with the word chaste to some degree. Commonly, when you hear the word chaste, you think of purity, and of course, chastity, the word chastity, which comes from the same root, would have reference to sexual purity. I think that there is something to be said with regard to that purity of demeanor and action, someone who is immaculate or pure from fault, is the concept that is found there. But it's seen in actually the verses 3 and following with regard to the adornment. In other words, the way of the world as it has always been from the beginning, it seems. It's what the writer of the book of Proverbs warns about, is the efforts that are made by women to entice men by their physical attributes, and the desire of men to be enticed by physical attributes. So men are very visual beings. Some women, base women, take advantage of that. And so this is the concept of lascivious and lewd behavior and lust on the part of man. These are the kinds of things that are prevalent. We see it every day in our society. There's an adage in the advertising world that sex sells, and there is a reason for that, and it's a truth. It does, and that's why you have all the advertising efforts made in that regard, because it certainly is effective. So that's kind of what people do, what women do. And it's not the way that God intends for it to be done. So there is a contrast there. So I want you to kind of think of that. A woman who uses impure means, efforts to seduce, to entice, to be an influence upon a man, and the possibility that a woman may use those, even use those things in order to influence her husband, that's not the way a Christian woman is to conduct herself. That's not an indication that there is something that is impure or inappropriate about the marriage bed. That's not the point. But the manipulation using the physical attributes, that's not the way Christian women conduct themselves. And so the way Christian women conduct themselves, specifically in verses 3 and following, is the adornment that is not merely outward but inward, the hidden person of the heart, the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. If you want to talk about chaste conduct, it is conduct that comes from or springs from an inner beauty, a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. So you have the gentle spirit, you have the quiet spirit, you have that inner beauty. And this is these are the characteristics that you seek to use to influence your husband to become a Christian. You don't try to manipulate. You don't try to browbeat or nag. You don't try to use any number of different tactics that maybe women have been guilty of using to try to win the man. But the way in which you do it is by consistently being chaste and consistently showing a reverential attitude toward God, because that's the second thing, and that is your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. And I think that it's obvious that that is fear of the Lord that's under consideration here. So those two things are the way in which you win your husband. And again, it's not a reference to being attractive to your husband. It's a reference to how is it that you're going to bring about this conversion of your husband. And by the way, also, this is what strengthens the marriage. The very same things we're talking about here that might bring a man to Christ are the things that characteristically a woman can do in order to strengthen her marriage and to be the type of woman and wife that God would have her to be. This is where the emphasis should lie for those women. So what he's basically saying is this is the way the world does it, and this is the way Christian women should act. And in so doing, it can be effective in actually bringing someone to Christ, even if they're not receptive to preaching. And there's a lot of truth to that. And again, I've seen it any number of times. So chastity, pure from every fault and immaculate, and accompanied by fear, that it's evident to the husband the reason that the woman is acting the way she's acting, the reason the woman is being consistent, the reason why the woman is persisting in her faith despite the antagonism he may show is because she fears God, because she loves the Lord, and because this is important to her. And when that consistency is there, it can really bring to bear a great deal of influence that can cause an individual to become, receptive to truth. Okay? So, with regard to that, consider the effectiveness of quiet and godly influence. Anyone want to add to that? The other thing that I wanted to note, just as a passage, just to make note of it, is the importance and the effectiveness of an example. Matthew 5, Jesus in his Sermon on the Mount, verse 16, he says, "Let your light so shine before men that they see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." That a godly influence, example, sometimes can offer the strongest persuasion. And so a woman should understand that. And by the way, if your husband is a Christian, this is also helpful. It doesn't change because he is a Christian as far as how you conduct yourself or act. The point here simply is that if you've got a husband who's not a Christian, by acting as a Christian woman should, you may bring him to Christ. But this is the kind of action that godly women are to have. In fact, that's obvious when you look at verses 5 and 6, because he said this is the way godly women acted in the past, and Sarah is the example to which she alludes. And that's the way you are to act as well. We'll get to the men in a minute. But that's what the Apostle Peter says about the wives' responsibility. Okay? Next question. What about makeup? What about jewelry? What about the styling of hair? Is that condemned in verse 3? Is it wrong for women to wear makeup?
it's not.
Okay.
Unless it takes precedence on everything else, the important things.
Okay, but wait a second, though. Because verse 3 says, verse 3, you know, of course, we're not trying to explain away something that's actually true. We do want to have an understanding of it. I want you to look at verse 3. If you have a New King James Version, and some of you may or may not, but there is a word that's inserted there. Do not let your adornment be merely outward. And that's an insertion. And so I want you to understand, first of all, the danger of reading these insertions and just reading over them without considering the fact that this is a word that's added. So you have, do not let your adornment be merely outward. If we took the merely out there, it would say, do not let your adornment be outward. Do not let your adornment be the arranging of hair. Do not let your adornment be the wearing of gold. Do not let your adornment be putting on fine apparel. Which would seem to be, and which is why you have some religious groups. For example, I think in some of the more conservative Assembly of God groups and that denomination, that they do not allow their children, I mean their wives to cut their hair or to wear makeup, and they dress very plainly. And I remember the first time I went to a debate, the very first debate I ever went to, it was a gospel preacher that was debating an Assembly of God preacher. And it was kind of interesting looking at the difference, because it's just like with anything else, you had our side and their side. You know, the members of the church sat on one side of the building and the Assembly of God people sat on the other. And you could very well tell how they took this particular passage and what they took it to mean by the way they were dressing and adorning themselves. Okay, so the word merely is inserted sometimes.
Fine on apparel, though.
Do what?
Fine apparel. Fine is
bad. Is inserted. Okay, good. So when we talk about the insertions, just understand this. The reason why an insertion of a word is put into a text is to make the meaning of the text more clear. In other words, it is something that is, when you look at a Greek text, and you look at a word-for-word translation of the Greek text, and you read a word-for-word translation, a couple of things happen. Number one, the words are mixed up in order. And number two, it's almost impossible to read, because the idea of a word-for-word equivalency, it just doesn't happen from language to language. So sometimes what the translators do is they will add words to make what was the Greek meaning the English meaning as well. So the insertion of words is necessary and it is important. However, the translators, if it is a good translation, then they will acknowledge that this is an inserted word so that you can examine the text to see whether the insertion is legitimate. And sometimes it's not. For example, I'll just give you an example. In Ecclesiastes chapter 12 and verse 13, fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. That's in the King James Version of the text. The word duty is an insertion. If you didn't read that, it's a little bit more awkward. Fear God, keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. And it is a little more awkward. You have to think about that a little bit, but it actually is a stronger statement and more in tune with what was intended by the writer of Ecclesiastes. It's not just your duty, it's your very essence. It's the reason why you exist, is because you're here to fear God and keep His commandments. So it can be something that's a little bit difficult. So I just wanted to make note of that, because I think that contextually, if what is intended by this particular text, that the merely, though an insertion, rightly gives us the essence of what the Apostle Peter is here saying. There are a couple of passages. It's not only this one here in 1 Peter chapter 3, but you might want to keep your finger there. Go over also 1 Timothy, the second chapter. 1 Timothy chapter 2. You notice verses 9 and 10 of that particular text, which is an indication of the way in which women are to conduct themselves in an assembly, in a worship assembly. And in verse 8, he says, I desire therefore that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting, in like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. The reason I bring this in, and of course this would be indicative not only of the assembly at other times as well, but there is a very clear not but statement here. So when you're talking about the adornment of women, as indicated in 1 Peter chapter 2, he's saying be proper in your adornment. Not saying that you shouldn't adorn yourself, but that your adornment should be proper. And your adornment, and this is the key, and I think it's what's indicated by the Apostle Peter in his text as well, that it should be something that is done in moderation. It is a moderate adornment there in verse 9 of the text. And so when we look at that, the word moderate comes from a word which the idea is being discreet, not being overt, not being outlandish. That's the concept of moderation in this text. So that's contrasted with someone who comes in and there is some elaborate hairdo. And again, when you read commentaries about this, they make note of the common practice of the Roman elite in that day and how they braided their hairs and interwove their hair with you know, lots of gold. It'd be similar, like I'm going to wear my hair every day like a bride has her hair done on her wedding day. You know, that kind of thing. And this is, but the idea of all of this is bringing attention to yourself. That you are dressing, let's say in an assembly, you're addressing in such a way as to show off. You're coming into the assembly so everybody look at you and say, wow, look at that. Look at the way she's dressed. And that's inappropriate. That kind of an attitude is inappropriate. So when you look at this, keep in mind the context in 1 Peter 3 with regard to how the woman is to influence her husband, how she's to appear to her husband. And so it's not to be that I'm a Christian lady, how do I want to approach my husband, influence him? What do I want to be important with regard to my interaction? I want it to be physical. I want it to be, you know, I want when my husband thinks of me, he thinks of a woman who is sexual, sensual, beautiful, alluring, all the physical attributes. The Apostle Peter says that's not the kind of woman you want to be. You want to be a woman when your husband thinks of you, he says, this is a kind woman. This is a gentle woman. This is a woman who is helpful and righteous and humble and quiet. That's the type of woman that you're to be. And so it's not the outward attributes, but rather the inward attributes that are important. Because this is the way they did it in the past. This is the way Sarah did it, as that example. So I think the merely there is something that is appropriate. It's not saying you can't wear earrings. It's saying that earrings better not be the way you think you're going to keep your man or influence your man or this is the way you want to be, this is what you want your relationship to be based upon. Because that's something that's not lasting, and it's also something that is not conducive to righteousness, and it's not conducive to converting him to righteousness either. Okay? So I think that's the emphasis that we wanted to make with regard to that. So, questions, comments about that? What's valuable? What's your value? That's what's under consideration. Yes, good.
Of course, a misunderstanding here, but fashions determine what modesty is for a woman. And don't misunderstand me, what that explained what I mean. Now, from Isaiah 57, verses 1 and 2, one question we go to, that the woman's skirt is below the knee. But in the early 1900s, if a Christian woman wore her skirt just barely above the knee, she'd be immodest. Showing the ankle was immodest.
Yeah, okay.
So things go on, now there's a point where it stops, you don't go,
right.
You know, like that.
Okay, so.
It's like when I was in the late 30s, the young girls, they didn't wear lipstick and that, but come, I got to. Well, ninth grade, but anyway, in the mid, in the 40s there, then in high school, the girls started wearing lipstick and that.
Yeah.
So now.
Okay, so let's talk about that just a little bit. Now, first thing I want to note is that in this particular text, when it talks about the adornment, if you're going to talk about modesty, the closest thing you have to do with modesty with regard to what something that is considered, you know, too short or too tight or inappropriate in that regard would be that conduct, that type of, that statement, chaste conduct. Because if you look at First Timothy 2, and in this particular text, when we're talking about modesty, it is in contrast to the concept of ostentatiousness. You know, if you say, I live in a modest home, or I live in a mansion, okay, that's the difference. Or I dress modestly would be that I'm not wearing a ton of gold and a ton of jewelry and a fancy dress all the time. That kind of stuff instead is something that is a modest dress. It's not having reference to something that shows too much cleavage or is too short-hemmed or anything like that. However, the Bible, of course, is very clear in drawing a line in regard to acceptable dress in that area of lewdness and lasciviousness. There's a term that is found most commonly in the Old Testament that is helpful in regard to that is as nakedness. And so what Dick is mentioning is, and I've illustrated this with Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Who wrote that? Is it Hawthorne? Actually, I can't remember. Anyway, I've used this illustration in the past. There is a passage in that particular story, The Legend of Sleepy Hollow, about the woman that Ichabod Crane was really attracted to. And it said that she was a little bit of a coquette, which kind of a seducer. It said that she had a fetchingly short petticoat that revealed the comeliest ankle in the county. In other words, her petticoat was too short because you could see her ankle. And that was something that was, you know, considered a little bit risque back then. So it was a matter of the time. So what does the Bible say about that? Well, the Bible has some things that are, I think, very clearly stated with regard to individuals who are naked, insufficiently clothed. But he's right in the sense that if a Christian, whether it's a man or a woman, were to buck the trends of the time, then he would lose his Christian influence. He would be considered, or she would be considered, as being dressed immodestly because, you know, back then, mid-calf, anything above that was immodest. And if you, all of a sudden, you're up to the knees, then ooh, look at you. You know, and that would be associated with a loose woman or someone who's inappropriate. So we've got to be careful about that. The point that I'm making is that Christians should never let fashion dictate how we dress. It doesn't make any sense. Now, there may be some time when what the Bible reveals as nakedness is something that, I mean, you look, for example, in some Muslim cultures where women can't uncover themselves at all. And there's nothing immodest with the way the ladies are dressed tonight, but Muslims would think so, and then their culture would be considered such. So culture's not the final determinant on that, but we have to be careful that we be lights in the world and dress accordingly in that regard. Problem in our day and time is not that, is it? Problem in our day and time is that both women and men dress immodestly. They are revealing themselves too much in public, and there's no excuse for that because the Bible condemns nakedness. And nakedness isn't being completely naked. It means insufficiently clothed, and we can give a number of examples of that. Perhaps we could go into that at another time. So is there clarity then with regard to the idea of the dress and the styling of hair and the makeup and such? All right, final point in this. Oh, no, actually, it's two more questions very quickly, but I think we'll get through them both. First of all, can you think of any examples of an incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit? I just wanted to say my wife. So she's not here, but let it be on record that she's an example of that. Ask if I said that, okay? But I'm not so much thinking about a particular woman because all the men here will say their wife, and I understand you saying that, too. But I'm talking about some examples that you have seen of a woman exhibiting a gentle and quiet spirit.
What comes to mind is Proverbs 31, verse 10 and following, with the virtuous woman.
Okay. Okay. Everyone's familiar with that. Her treatment of her husband, treatment of her children, industrious nature. Humility, those are things that exact. So the virtuous woman, Proverbs 31, is a good example. Yes.
I don't have a wife, but one thing that did
I'm sorry, son.
Was, and along with the effectiveness of two questions before, the example of Jesus that he did give in chapter 2, of course, in a slightly different context specifically, it reminded me of the conversion of the thief on the cross, because he was continuing to mock Jesus and such with the other thief, and eventually something changed. And a possibility is his quiet spirit on the cross enduring all of that pain and suffering. And that might have triggered something within that thief to lead him to believe.
To see that there's something different about that Jesus.
And with regard to what you're talking about before, the power is in the gospel. It's very possible he, being a Jew, knew who Jesus was and was just continuing in his life of sin because he didn't want to comply with God's word. And eventually, when he sees it play out in Jesus on the cross in the worst time in his life, that led to that conversion.
Okay, good. Which is completely different from what I was thinking, because I was trying to bring in mind women doing that. But Jesus, of course, serves as a wonderful example of that. You want to know a gentle and quiet spirit, what's under consideration there, look to the Lord, because he's even at that most difficult time in his life, on the cross itself, is there. Good point. Anybody else? Some of the things that I have in mind or thought is one thing that I really love to see, and it's present in a lot of women, but when you see it, the kindness that they showed us to children, for one. And especially the young mothers, when you see them interacting with their children, Christian mothers interacting with their children. One of these days, hopefully, I'll get this family to visit Westside. But our next door neighbors, the way they treat their children, I cringe. You know, it's just kid. They've got a little boy that he's rambunctious and he's out in the front yard, and just their tone of voice that they're always using, telling him no and stop and get in here and quit that and just that. But it's the language that they use. It's the harshness of the tone. It's their impatience. I mean, I understand it because the kid is a handful, but a Christian mother, number one, her child would probably be more well-behaved, but her interactions with that child would certainly be far different from what I witnessed with that lady. So, you know, you can see that with regard to Christian women. So kindness to children is one, the hospitality. But another thing that I see that is really amazing to me, and I appreciate it, is something that we're going to benefit from with Debbie being down for a few days, with the example shown by the women of this congregation in caring for those who are sick and elderly, the making of meals and the concern shown and the care, those kinds of things. You know, that's the type of thing that a man who's worth his salt, he's going to look at a woman like that and he's going to say, you know, that's a good person. That's a person who's righteous, and that's the kind of person that I want to have as my mate. Or I'm proud that she is my wife because this is the way she acts and conducts herself. And you know how we are in our society. And I think as men, again, we're probably the greatest cause of all of this. Is there is such an emphasis that is placed on physical beauty, which fades. And, you know, one of the interesting things that I see when I go to funerals, I say that what happens these days is the PowerPoint presentations that they show, and you look at all of the pictures from the past, and it's so neat to see the couple when they were very young and how just full of life and skin free of wrinkles and the beauty that you see there and the handsomeness and the virility that you see there. And that goes away. You know, it just does as time goes on, as you get older. But the beauty of the spirit grows, and it strengthens, and it gets better as time goes on. It doesn't fade at all. And that's the kind of thing that you want. So that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. You contrast that with those who are brash and forward. One of the things that really, really just makes me cringe is in all the protests that we see on television now. And you see the protest, I don't know if y'all saw this when, again, without the politics coming into play, but Sherman's statue came down. And it was a bizarre thing to see people kicking a metal statue. And but they were doing that, you know, when they were spitting on it and they were kicking it and they were booting it. But there was one woman in that video clip that she just come unglued. She was just, she bound to have broke her foot by doing it, but she just and you see other women getting in the face of people and just screaming and using obscene gestures and the language and the profanity and that kind of harshness that you see. And I think to myself, when did it happen that women started acting that way? You know, I guess there have always been some women that are that way in every generation, but it just seems like maybe that women's lib movement of the 70s is kind of, this has come to roost in a little way as far as women's attitude in public. And I know it's politically incorrect to say that women ought not to act that way. Men ought not to act that way either. But it is certainly a masculine attribute. You know, that's the way men act. And you know, and ungodly men act that way, and they shouldn't. And godly men don't act that way. But again, in the past, when you saw people acting that way, it was men that were doing it. But now it's women as well. And it's just such an ugly thing to see. And that's not the way Christian women are being. Yes, sir.
I'm just reminded more of the examples that you find. So I think of like, you know, Ruth and her heart. Think of Hannah. Of course, Sarah is the obvious example there. But then I think of the examples of like Esther or the, you know, the Proverbs 31 woman, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't know here, but of course it seems to me it's a very, very fine balance of leadership qualities and grace that has to exist within the woman at the same time, where there's a submission to it. But you know, the Proverbs 31 woman is very, very industrious, and she's in the forefront of that. You know, Esther
was queen.
Esther, yeah, and she goes to the forefront and defies the king. I mean, that goes contrary to this form of submission, but this leadership that steps in, where that sort of role naturally falls to a man, that's still present within a woman, but that's got to be difficult. You know, I can only imagine to also present that with grace as well. I don't know. It's interesting to me too, with that part of that.
That's, and those are some of the most beautiful stories that you find. I mean, the character of Ruth, both with regard to her mother-in-law and her interaction with Boaz, is just an amazing woman in that regard. Those are the two examples that I have, by the way. He took the two, Ruth and Esther.
We're getting the next
one. No, that's fine. And that's our last question. Sarah's one example. Can you think of any others? So you might want to write this down. Just take the time to read the second chapter of Ruth, verses 10 through 13. And this particular aspect was her, when Boaz saw her gleaning in the field, and his treatment of her and her interaction with him is just a beautiful thing. And then Esther in chapter 4, verses 15 and 17, when Mordecai gave her instructions and she submitted to his desire and basically said, I'll go to the king, and if I perish, I perish. But that strength of character and that submissive heart in Esther's case. Those are two examples. Did anybody have any others that they wrote down besides Hannah, Ruth, Esther? Sarah is given as an example. The proverb, the virtuous woman, Proverbs 31. Anybody else? Anybody thought of?
Abigail.
Okay. Yeah, Abigail. So, I mean, we could probably, you know, there's plenty of women in the Bible that you could refer to. And of course, the unfortunate thing, sometimes, you know, this book is not really that thick when you're thinking about all the history that's involved. Sometimes I wish that we had more knowledge of those characters and their lives and their day-to-day activities. And I think we would see there are a lot of people named in the Bible that are just that, just named, that if we knew more about them, they probably would be amazing examples to us as well. But we can certainly look at those.
Lois, grandmother?
Yeah, the grand, Luke, Eunice, and Lois, yeah, me too, the mother and grandmother of Timothy, we get examples. Okay, we will talk about the husbands next week. So you ladies that were wanting us to do that, come back next week, and you can talk about all you want.